Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, hello again.
Hello, Ned.
Hello, Ned.
It's been a very long time since we've met in person. Not since Oxford, those heady days of Oxford.
That was really lovely, wasn't it? I had a really nice day out, and we're in a slightly less glamorous but equally interesting place.
This is close. This is my manor. We're quite close to my part of London now. This is Borough.
We're in a beautiful petrol station forecourt that's been transformed for the day by Brompton, complete with a lovely painting on the ground. There's some palm trees, there's some massive trees in planters, and there's loads of people hanging around. There's loads of Brompton bikes that you can hire. And
yeah, or just ride off with, because I just did that. I jumped on an electric one.
We've
up to St Giles Circus or whatever that's called up there. No, that's not St Giles Circus.
St George Circus,
I think it might be. Yeah, you're right.
I should say you've got...
We just claimed it was my manor. I then just completely misnamed it. Sorry, Adam.
You've got a very trusting face, so that's why.
Yeah, as Laura says, we're right in the heart of Borough, very close to Borough Market, the astonishingly expensive chorizo and olive emporium that is Borough Market, right opposite the Inner London Crown Court, where I served for 2 weeks as a juror a few years ago. And what a fascinating process that was. And it is World Bike Free Day, and I have... It's what? No, not Bike Free, that's completely wrong. It's World Car Free.
It's literally the opposite. It's World Car Free Day.
It's World Car Free Day, and as I just established riding up from Lewisham to get here, it's a 20-minute ride. I have never seen London so congested or busy with cars. I'm not convinced that the brethren behind the wheels have quite got the message that today is a day to leave your car at home. Would you agree?
It's not been observed.
Not diligently, no.
No, yeah. I feel like the air is particularly smelly today, in fact, actually.
Well, none of this is our fault, I don't think. But, I mean, explain the history of World Car Free Day, Adam.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know.
You don't know. I've just sprung that on you.
No. World Car Free Day is an annual thing. It's obviously one of those days that we have days for everything now, don't we? But World Car Free Day, I think, is quite interesting because it's sort of based on the back of these kind of car-free days that you have in cities where actually a lot of people go, oh, quite like this. I could do this, maybe do it once a year, and then it becomes once a month, and then maybe, you know, it could be once a week, and then maybe you can have this sort of every day. And one of the challenging things, I think, actually, is the words car-free, because actually I don't think that's a good explanation of what people are trying to achieve. We're just sort of trying to get people to use their cars less, aren't we? And we're sort of accepting that cars will form some form of transport, which is using for the wrong job. So I think it plays a little bit into Car Free Day is sort of, oh, we don't want cars ever. Well, we might not want cars ever, actually, but the reality of the situation is we're going to have cars, but we probably don't need them for short journeys, and we probably don't need as many as there are in Borough right now. So it's a good way to get people, I think, to think about the use of public space, how much space we give over to cars, which is quite interesting. Quite interesting why, you know, being here in a massive petrol station that now has been taken over, it's got a parklet at the end, it's got people having coffee, and it's a good way for normal folk to go, actually, we give quite a lot of space to cars, don't we? Maybe we could take some of it back and do nice things with it. So that's why I like World Car Free Day. Anyway, no history involved, but that's why I like it.
Well, to make that point, there's a parking bay there, isn't there, just by one of the sort of defunct petrol pumps in this disused petrol station, marked out on the tarmac to the rough proportions of a standard car, and they've managed to fold down and stack 42 Bromptons in the space of one car, which is a pretty good way of making a very cogent point, I think. Yeah. Talking about car-free days, wasn't there, in the aftermath of the Queen's death, a London borough who, as a mark of respect, cancelled their car-free day? There were some quite mystifying cancellations of various different events, and also some events I was working on, one that simply had to be cancelled for logistical reasons, but that struck me as an odd way to mark the passing of a monarch, to cancel a car-free day. I think it's Hammersmith and Fulham,
yeah,
was it?
It was Hammersmith and Fulham, and I saw that. Obviously, we know why things were cancelled. A lot of things were cancelled. And then, of course, I don't want to twist the knife too much because everyone's done that already, but British Cycling issued guidance, didn't they, as well, to tell people they shouldn't ride their bike on the day of the Queen's funeral.
I mean, they had a brain fart, didn't they? They really did, and very quickly retracted it, I think. It was an odd one.
But we've got that kind of blind spot, haven't we, where driving cars is normal. And, you know, riding a bike is a luxury or some sort of specific thing that, as a mark of respect, you shouldn't do. It's like, it doesn't take into consideration key workers who might have to go to work that day. You know, don't ride your bike because of the Queen. Doesn't really make much sense. I quite like the royal family, and I've been, you know, looking up and looking at what Prince Charles, now King Charles, has been saying over the past many decades. And one of the things he said is that cities need to get control of the motor vehicle and give space back to pedestrians. That's something that our king has been saying, and we know that he's got quite strong views on the environment and climate and all things, which I think's interesting. So I think he'd want us to be riding our bike on the day of the Queen's funeral, probably.
Yeah, I agree. What have you been up to, Laura?
Cycling. Been doing a lot of cycling.
How's it going? You're still on your odyssey around the UK, aren't you?
Yeah, still on my odyssey. It's been ridiculous, actually. Been doing a lot of travel. So last week I was helping build a cycle route. I was doing a dry stone wall and doing some digging. And it was quite fun, actually. Went camping. And the guy who founded Sostrand still kind of does these work camps where he builds his own cycle routes in various places around the country, and he's still a force of nature. So that was quite a fun experience, actually, to get my hands dirty and get on some gloves and start building a stone wall. So,
well, for those outside of the active travel Sostrans bubble, as succinctly as possible, can you just outline the history of Sostrans and when it came about? And it's quite a well-known story within this world, but it is actually genuinely interesting, isn't it, how it started?
Yeah, it is quite interesting. Yeah, it started with the Bristol to Bath railway path, and this chap, doing the same thing as we were doing last week, basically got some people together, managed to buy...
Has he got a name, Laura?
Land, John Grimshaw.
John Grimshaw.
Yes, good point. He just kind of decided that this was going to be a good idea, make form a rail path into a cycle path. So that's what he did, got people digging, got all sorts of people from kind of youth employment schemes from the government, and and it kind of grew from there, turned into a charity, which is now Sustrans, which now runs the National Cycle Network, and he's no longer part of it, but he's got his own charity which kind of does a similar thing that he's always done, and he seems to be very good at it, negotiating with people and just making things happen. So yeah, we're here in this forecourt, and we've actually got some quite interesting people around us, haven't we?
More interesting than us?
Yeah. Should we go and
we're good, walkie talkie style, go on.
I think we should go, and over there we've got the climate charity Possible, who today launched a parklet plotter. So this is something quite close to Laura and I, my hearts, because we've got parklets in our local communities that we've kind of been doing. And they've actually got a map that is showing where the best place to put a parklet would be based on the lack of green space, based on deprivation, based on car ownership. And they've launched that today, and they're actually getting members of the public to come and tell them where they think a parklet should be. So actually going to local councillors, emailing local councillors and saying, we want a parklet and we want it now, which is actually in their gift. So we should speak to Hera first.
Well, I hope you've left them something to say, because you've basically summed up the project. Hello, I'm Ned. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Ned. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
And you're what's your name again?
My name's Hera Khan Adiogan. I'm head of Car Free Cities at the climate action charity Possible.
Fabulous. Hello, I'm Ned. Nice to meet you.
Hello, Ned. I'm Carolyn. I'm Car Free London campaigner. Yours is a voice I'm very familiar with, because I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, are you? Well, good. That's nice. I've never met a fan of the podcast before.
That's lovely. And we have Jules Walker, of Jules Walker fame.
Just a name and a brand in her own right. She's just working as a photographer at the moment, taking a picture of us. Anyway, we're deviating from the point of you being here. Do you want to sum it up? I mean, Adam's given us a little potted history of what you're all about, but do you want to put it in your words?
Yeah, Yeah, so we at Possible are aiming for a zero carbon Britain built by and for everyone. And we know that transport emissions are our highest contributor to our carbon emissions, and private cars are the biggest contributor within that. So we want to campaign to take space away from cars and give it back to people and nature, and live in cities where, you know, that are cleaner, greener and safer. And parklets are one small way that we can do that. And it gives an opportunity for residents to take back space and pull communities together. You know, there's lots of different ways people can do it, but why is space allocated so unfairly? Why do you need to own a car to have access to public space? So these are the questions that we're raising, and we would like to see a permanent parklet permit process across all
PPP.
Councils, a PPP across all councils in the UK, because that's the future, that's the way to do it.
What's the definition of a parklet?
Oh, a parklet, the way we define it, is taking a parking space and transforming it into a space for communities. So it can look like anything. You can grow vegetables, you can have cycle storage there, you can have seating, you can have benches, you can have a little library, whatever you want, really. But it's space for communities that used to be a parking space.
So as things stand, if I want to create, I live in the borough of Lewisham, right? I wouldn't suggest for a second you have to be an expert in the politics of Lewisham borough, because there's lots of London boroughs. But if I wanted to create a parklet on my very normal street in London, what would I do? Would I go to the, would I mean, is this the point of your campaign?
I mean, this is the point of the campaign. Most councils don't currently have a process. There are, I think, two only at the moment in London. There's Hackney, and I think, what was the other one?
Hounslow just announced theirs, yep.
That's the other one. But otherwise,
and Forest have also announced theirs today for Car Free Day.
They're coming out of the woodworks now. Yeah. But basically, that most councils don't have a process. Mm. You would have to talk to your neighbours, get a real movement going, put proposals to councillors, have lots and lots of meetings, discuss health and safety, all of that jazz. And it might take a long time. And that's kind of what Carolyn's been doing in Waltham Forest.
Yeah, I mean, a good place to start if you wanted to do that, Ned, would to get in touch with the Parklet campaign, because there's a wealth of experience there. There's lots of grassroots campaigners, many of whom have created their own parklets, particularly in Hackney, but also in other areas. Mm. And you could also use our Write to Your Councillor parklets tool. So if anybody wants to go to the Possible website and look at our page on parklets, there's a ready-made tool. You can, you know, send an email to your councillor asking for a parklet permit process. And often, you know, councillors will be looking at what other boroughs are doing. So, for example, we had a pop-up parklet yesterday outside a school in Ealing. We had a lot of councillors and council officers come down from Hounslow, and we're trying to sort of say to Ealing, look what they're doing in the borough next door. Can you try and catch up? Because they're really sort of like setting the example.
Laura Bowman's chipping here, because I know that this is an area of your great interest and expertise as well. But the process is for putting in cycle hangers, if you've got enough residents on the street that want that. That's been fairly well established, hasn't it, in most councils, I think, for a number of years. So isn't it simply a question of cut and paste that process and sort of apply it for a slightly different use, Laura? Wouldn't it? I mean, isn't, you know, it's not beyond the wit of man, this, is it?
Yeah, it seems like a good idea. And I mean, I know in a lot of boroughs, including mine, the waiting list for those cycle hangers is very, very long. There's just not enough of them going round, or I'm not sure. Yeah.
The physical thing.
I don't know. It seems to take councils a long time to get them in. And yeah, it's just a very slow process. For my parklet, I got mine through Community Assembly Fund, and it was a sort of building that had been semi knocked down, and there was a space that people were using as parking, and it wasn't actually a parking bay, but I kind of managed to get around the process just by asking people, and just nobody said no, and so I kind of made it happen. But there doesn't seem to be a process in a lot of boroughs, and so it is quite difficult. But it's a good idea, actually, just cut and paste that, if they could speed that up, because there is a huge waiting list for those cycle hangers. So
yeah. Just to offer a bit of an insight into the situation with cycle hangers, sometimes there are also production issues that Cycle Hoop or whoever the contractor is can't actually produce them quickly enough, and it's also the funding issue. So it costs between £7,000 and £8,000 to put one of those cycle hangers in, and of course they have to do the consultation, they have to do the traffic management orders. There's quite a lot of work that has to go into that. Some areas they have been vandalised because people are not happy to see them go in, so there's a huge amount of kind of resources, and sometimes local authorities are lacking in terms of the human resources at officer level. If a councillor comes out, you know, a council leader comes out, as they have in Hackney, and said, we're going to quit clear the waiting list of six or 7,000 people, that's great, but then they've got to make sure the resources are there to put that in. And that's exactly what we want to see, is a similar process for the parklets, because at the moment it's happening where there are people like Laura that are doing all that kind of grassroots community work, but it's a lot of engagement, it's a lot of like volunteer hours that you're having to put in. If there was a process, then people could turn it around in a sort of more accessible way.
Yeah, you kind of compare it to the process of getting yourself a parking space on the street, and it's, you know, it couldn't be easier, especially in inner city boroughs where most people don't own cars. It's really, it's really quite unequal.
So I know Adam wants to jump in, but I was just struck because now you mentioned that, you've got an infographic just behind me that says quite clearly, it's quite striking when you read it, isn't it?
Yeah.
The weekly cost to park a private car on public space, £3.28. The weekly cost to suspend a parking bay for a parklet, £325. So where do those figures come from? Where does the £325 a week figure come from?
That's an aggregate, so that's across all the boroughs in London. So that's sort of taken the aggregate figures for all of those 33 boroughs.
Good grief, how can they justify that?
Well, that's kind of the point that we're making. Why does it cost so much money? To, if you want to suspend a parking bay for a week, that's how much it's going to cost you. But if you want to just stick your car in, and that's where Adam did that brilliant thing of just, you know, putting a parklet on top of a car and there you go.
It's so clever.
Have you seen the cartoon on Twitter that shows exactly that? Somebody put a cartoon on Twitter where there's a penguin being told can't use this space. So he comes back and lies on top of a car. What Adam did. So for example, the pop-up parklet that we did in Ealing yesterday, that cost us £90 for three spaces, £30 per space, but we were providing and that was a huge amount of community benefit. We had a woman playing guitar, singing nursery rhymes for the little kids. We were giving out pizza. We had kids playing with toys. We had basically the whole community taking over the space throughout the whole day, particularly before and after school, and asking, are you going to be here every day? Is this, you know, is this permanent? And when you think the amount of community benefit that's bringing compared to it being used for a parking space, that's what we're trying to raise awareness of, is that it's essentially storing somebody's private property on the street, and it's being really heavily subsidised.
Paradigm shift in thinking that you've got to bring about, isn't it? Because I think there's just a lack of thought going on to extent. You know, I think just listening to your testimony here and looking at that startling figure, it seems to me that people at council level are associating the closure of a parking space with a kind of the closure of a road, as if it's a sort of almost a civil sort of action that needs to be, you know, implemented with all sorts of ramifications that simply aren't there. So I think it's just confused thinking, and if there's a bit more clarity that comes about with your campaign, then I think that figure will drop. It must do, surely. You've been itching to get in for ages, and we've only got one microphone, so it's down to me who I call to speak at any point. I'm firmly in control.
You're like a this morning presenter who's got to like try and there's a competition in 6 minutes, Ned. You've got to keep talking until there.
I should explain that we've only, because we just decided to do this podcast like 10 minutes ago, I've only got one microphone, so that's why it sounds like it does at the moment.
I was just going to ask Kira, because she's been here today talking to members of the public who have been walking past, and actually you can't visualise this, but I'm going to try and explain it to you. But there's
just a picture.
There's this big petrol.
You've got a better word than big. Come on.
Ginormous. Running out of superlatives here. There's a large forecourt, basically. And what it does is it creates severance between these two main roads that you've got. So what people do is they walk through the forecourt to get to the other side of the road. Whereas the planners, what they wanted to do was to get them to walk all the way around, which would have taken ages. Anyway, so you get quite a lot of people walking through here, just normal folk, not that interested in car-free day or whatever, but here has been talking to them. So I just wonder, for me, parklets are a really good way to start to have a conversation with people about the use of public space in a way they've never really thought about it before. And I just wondered if you had any kind of anecdotes of not eco-warriors, but normal folk who are just like, oh yeah, that's quite a good idea, and what they think to it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. That's generally the reaction that we get to parklets, because it's not about closing a road down. It's not about, you know, LTNs that you see. This is about creating space for communities, and people can actually see and feel the value. It's also quite a small intervention, so people don't really see it as threatening. They see it as very welcoming. And, you know, we were talking about the parklet yesterday. We've described it to people. There's nothing more wonderful or joyous than seeing little children singing nursery rhymes with a guitar and having fun in a space that used to be preoccupied by a car. Just normal everyday folk who probably, you know, the climate isn't right at the very top of their agenda. Sustainable transport is probably not right at the top of their agenda. But they can see that something like, why does it cost £3.28 to park your car there? And why would it cost £300 plus to put a bench in there, for example? It's common sense.
It absolutely is.
I think I've just spotted out the corner of my eye Julian Scriven. He's wearing a fetching, I'm trying to be descriptive now, I'm under pressure. He's wearing a fetching red jacket, and he is the chap who's responsible for Brompton Bike Hire, who also are talking about repurposing space because they actually fit in these little hubs that you can put four bikes in, basically, and anyone can hire them. I'd like to speak to him about that.
Well, should we walk over there?
Let's do that with your one microphone.
Good luck, guys.
Thank you.
Very nice to meet you. Keep up the good work. I'm going to lobby Lewisham Council, see if we can get a parklet on my street. That would be a thing to do.
Massive trees here. There's some massive trees here, and I'm wondering how they got here. They're really quite
large.
Back
of a lorry?
Maybe a cargo bike. Who knows? That would have been a funny thing.
Yeah. So, Gina, I said that you were wearing a very fetching. It's actually even a Brompton jacket, which is totally,
on brand.
Very fetching and red. We were talking about repurposing public space. So obviously, that's what we're doing today at the petrol station, getting people to think about it. But you do this every day with your bike docks, really, because a lot of people are thinking, well, I don't want to give up much space. The councils are trying to give opportunities to get people access to bikes. And you can do that by popping these things up, which are quite inconspicuous, but give a whole new meaning to the landscape. And the other thing I just wanted to mention before I shut up is the stuff you've been doing with housing developers as well, because they're also starting to think, well, actually, what's our developments for? And they can actually put these in the basement and not have to give so much space over to bike parking and things like that. They can just give a little hub and everyone can use it.
I think actually what's even better is we're encouraging them not to put them in the basements, but to put them in the reception and outside the front of the building. And the reason why that's so important is the whole point behind our hire system is to bring people into cycling and to be a really cheap and accessible way for people to try it. So the last place someone is going to go to is down into the basement where all smells a bit of lycra and it's quite masculine.
Sometimes you're in as well.
Yeah, sometimes. Whereas, you know, if you put the hire location in where people are non-cyclists are, you know, if you want to go and catch a fish, you go to a pond, not to a desert. So if you want to catch non-cyclists, you go to the reception, not the cycle hub. And actually, we see that works really effectively. What's really interesting is property developers, when I first started working on this a few years ago, they were seeing it as a bit of a wheeze. Maybe I can get away with a bit less space devoted to cycling if I put in one of these small Brompton docks. They're now converting the other way around and saying, actually, if I put in one of these Brompton docks, it's going to encourage more people to cycle, which means more of that cycle parking, which I've had to pay a fortune on, will get used. And then that makes them feel good. And it also means then they have this buzzword, placemaking, which is a fancy way of saying, put nice stuff in and people will live there.
On that nice stuff and that even that useful stuff, we've just been chatting to Possible, who are obviously talking about parklets and things like that. You're sort of involved in kind of, I'm going to describe them loosely, this is unfair, but like corporate parklets in a sense, because you've got what are called mobility hubs, right? So you're working with, I think, Enterprise, car rental. So actually taking car parking spaces and saying they're not just for cars anymore, but we can have all these different mobility options for you.
Absolutely. And I think the big thing that's changed over the last few years is all the non-private car companies used to argue over compete in a way. And then we kind of sat down and realised that over 80% of journeys have been taken in private cars. And actually, what we should do is switch that round so it's 80% not in cars. Once we've done that, we can then argue whether it should be a bus or a bicycle or a car club car. But until then, let's work together. And mobility hubs are brilliant. They're really effective. You get this multiplier effect. So we're setting one up in Stratford with Newham Council and a fantastic property developer called Hadley Property Group. And the whole point behind it is going to have bicycles, it's going to have car club, it's got a bus stop there, it's right by Stratford International Station, and it's even going to have an app for the local people to use, which will have mobility credits like you had in Coventry, Adam. So there'll be mobility credits that people can use for free bike hire and for free car club hire, just to encourage people to try it. Because actually, the most important thing for me is to get people to start thinking about their mode of transport. And this sounds really simple, but for me, it's so key. If we could get people just to use the most appropriate mode of transport for the journey they're taking, that's the biggest win. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? But actually, it's that little thought process, not just climbing straight into the car, but just stopping for a moment and going, would I be quicker on a bike? Would it be easier in the London Underground? If we can get that thought going, and I think things like mobility hubs, things like software solutions with mobility credits, help us get people to nudge in that direction.
I've got a couple of Bromptons, which have been kindly provided by Brompton down the years.
David Miller gave you one, didn't he? Gave you a shiny one.
Yeah, because we ride all over the Alps, don't we? We're on the Tour de France on them and all that. And so that's very good. And I, but thinking about, you know, the most appropriate tool for the journey in question, that's exactly how I use my Brompton. So most of the time I actually don't ride it, because I reserve it for those moments where it's so useful, where I know that that's a Brompton journey. That's exactly right. Often in London, that'll be a day where I think I might get really wet.
Yeah.
So I know I can just fold it up and jump on the bus or the tube if I really don't want to get wet on that particular day. So it is, I mean, I do that with every journey now, but I didn't used to, you know, 10 years ago, I really didn't used to.
I mean, I love the multimodality of a Brompton, and that's a very fancy way of saying, because it folds up, you can take it on other modes of transport. I mean, today I came from the factory and I took the train or the underground to Oxford Circus and then jumped on the Brompton and got here. That was the best way of getting here.
And you can take it on any train all day round, and that's a huge advantage, because Laura, you and I know perfectly well, all of us know, that getting a bike on a train in the UK can be an absolute nightmare that involves very often sitting talking to someone in a call centre in India for half an hour before you can even get it. But Brompton just goes straight on, doesn't it?
Well, what's really interesting is train companies are now figuring out that they need to encourage people back onto the trains, and so they're looking at how do we get more people on trains, and they realise actually they need to make it friendlier, which means more bikes. So ironically, British company, we've been approached by Deutsche Bahn in Germany to provide Bromptons as part of season tickets. So if you buy a season ticket in Stuttgart at the moment, you can add on a Brompton, and for €29 a month you can have a Brompton as part of your season ticket.
What?
And it will literally be delivered to your door. So literally, your season ticket will turn up, and so will your Brompton. You can climb on your Brompton, cycle to the train station, and you're off and going. Now, I'd love to get that going in the UK as well. Train companies are not quite as progressive over here yet. But the Deutsche Bahn have figured it out. They need to get more bikes on trains. Folding bikes fit better than non-folding bikes. So your season ticket can have a Brompton.
Oh, that's very cool.
Very interesting.
That's very cool.
Thank you, Julian. It's a wealth of knowledge, as always. We're going to have a little wander around, but we're having a nice day here. The sun's out, isn't it? Sun's out.
Yeah.
Had a coffee, haven't you?
I haven't had a coffee.
Oh, you did straight into it.
Yeah. Little cargo bike coffee.
Yeah.
You should probably
should go get a coffee.
Okay, yeah, let's go and have a coffee. And I can see Jules is great, isn't she? Yeah.
Well, we're going to go and order ourselves a coffee. Why don't you go floor manage Jules over here?
Yeah.
Get some audio of the tap tap.
I'll get some audio of the tap tap tap. you're directing this now as well, aren't you, Adam? Can we have a couple of coffees, please? Would that be all right? Laura, what sort of coffee do you want?
What was that? That looked nice, like an Americano.
Long black.
Yeah, let's have one of those, please, with some oat milk.
Can I have a flat white, please? Would that be all right? Thank you very much. That looks lovely, my coffee, doesn't it? And on we go then.
So we've got Jules Walker, who is, you know, collectively someone we all know, one of our favourite people in cycling, always smiling, always looking incredibly well-dressed and trendy, and putting me to shame because I just throw on clothes. Although Laura looks very good today, like your scout Laura. This is sort of becoming a bit weird now, isn't it? Ned is wearing a grey T-shirt with one trouser leg rolled up.
Hello.
Cycle style.
I like cycling. But Jules, we're here today, we're all having a nice time, sun's shining. I'm particularly interested in all the different, I wouldn't call it sort of, there's different groups. Like, people are coming in from work, having a coffee because it's sort of free coffee, if they're walking and cycling. We've got people who are clearly, Brompton super fans. They've, upgraded their Brompton. They've got very specific upgrades to them. And we've got people who are kind of, coming in, someone on a Santander cycle. Yeah. Anyway, what I'm saying is that the crowd of what you call cyclists is diversifying quite a bit, and that's something you've been championing for a long, long time, isn't it?
Yes, it's been 12 years that I've been in the cycling industry and working as a cycling activist or cycling community builder, as I prefer to say. And what is interesting, and just what Adam was saying as well, is that cyclist in air quotes, you have a stereotypical image of what a cyclist or a person on a bike looks like. But the fun thing is that it's such a wide and varied and multifaceted community. There are so many different types of people who are out there who enjoy riding bikes, want to get into cycling culture, finding their way into it. And you don't have to look, act or be a certain way to do it. I'm a firm believer that cycling should be for everybody. And that's what we're seeing here today. At the moment, like Adam was saying, the people that are around us, you've got people coming in on Santair bikes, you've got folks just coming in post-work, lunchtime. And it's a lovely, varied mix of people. And that's what we need to see more of in the world of cycling.
Well, it's not just the people who are coming to this this pop-up sort of just, I don't know, display area, whatever you call it, this event. It's actually just some people riding by and just casting us a look. You know, the cycling community in London has got a lot bigger, really quite fast, I think, over the last two or three years. I don't know whether the evidence backs that up, but but alongside the numbers, I think it's changed hugely in terms of who's cycling. I mean, have we got any way of measuring that, Jules?
I know there are some statistics out there. I'm not a statistics person, so I'm not going to pretend and start spouting them to you. But what I can see from, I don't know, I guess being in the industry and then working with people in grassroots at cycling, you're seeing some of the different community building groups that are out there. So for me, it's like the Black Unity bike ride that happened a few weeks ago is an amazing example of that. That was like, I think it was like 1,200 black and brown bodies on bikes, like riding through London. You're seeing these kind of things happening. You're seeing this shift and this change. So for me, when I first started out on the scene 12 years ago, I had that feeling that I didn't really see very many people that looked like me or came from my background who were into riding bikes. 12 years later, I'm now really pleased to say that it really has diversified and changed. And the fact that there are brands and organizations that are moving in the right direction towards inclusivity and diversity, they understand the importance of that. If you want to encourage more people to come in, you need to bring more voices to the table. You need to be engaging with communities that you would otherwise have just ignored because they didn't fit your demographic. We're out here and we're enjoying being on bikes, and this is a prime spot for people watching. The different kind of folks that are going past on the rental bikes that you see, the different kind of commuters, all shapes and sizes on bikes. So it's been wonderful to see that shift.
Yeah, it's really lovely to see. And the community is really, really important, I've learned in my kind of years of writing and talking about cycling. And having people to support you into cycling. And that's really grown. And you've been such a pivotal part of that in London. And I always admire your positivity and your drive and your just enthusiasm and love for this whole community building stuff. And it's just wonderful to see things sort of growing. But I guess there's still a ways to go. I saw Ideas with Beers last week. And Dulce Pedrosa has done some research about, it's called And Still I Cycle, and she's talked to a lot of people about how women, particularly women of colour as well, and she was saying that people kind of contacted her when she put a shout out saying, oh, can I join your bike ride? Can I like come and speak to you? But I want to, but I'm not like a proper cyclist, or like I don't have the right kit. And it was really interesting. And there was this assumption that you had to be like a certain way. And she found this really interesting and kind of did a little bar chart of the people that contacted her and the questions they'd asked. And it was all about this perception of being a proper cyclist. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. As one of the things that I talked about in my book was the whole definition of what a proper cyclist is. And it's like, to me, there's no such thing. It's just, if you want to get on your bike and enjoy it, that's at its core. And I know in the days when I started to get into road cycling, for example, because I didn't have the proper shoes or I didn't have the proper like Lycra, it was just like,
it's disgraceful.
It was like one of the things that stands out in my head is when I did my first big road bike ride, which was from Portsmouth to Bognor Regis, and I was really proud of myself for it. I did it in Lycra kit, but I had on a pair of Converse trainers, and I got slated on social media because I didn't have
quite
the
right
shoes.
Imagine doing that without the proper shoes.
But I was just like, do you know what? This is, that in itself is like a barrier for folks.
It completely is. Yeah. Completely is. Yeah.
So it's just that kind of, that change in attitudes towards what a proper cyclist is. It's just like, we need to move away from that. And it's more about encouraging the joy and the freedom that comes with just being able to get on a bike. And obviously, having those kind of groups and communities that are taking up space and building these spaces for that to happen, it's important to encourage the growth of that too.
Well, just as you guys have been talking, I've been watching the people going up and down the street. There's a guy on rollerblades who is not only incredibly cool, but he's also really good at it. Like, so he's just dancing around the place, literally, like in the middle of the street, which is probably not that advisable, but it's great to watch. He's really good. There's a guy just going past, young guy with a rucksack on his back on a road bike. Mm-hmm. I've seen someone go past on a scooter. There's a Santander bike rider coming towards me right now with a pair of shades on, that one little earpiece in, maybe having to listen to a podcast with his shirt open, no helmet on. Rollerblades guy still doing his bits. There was another young lad who just came past on an electric Lime hire bike, which is suddenly sort of everywhere in London and seemed to be well used. And there's a slightly more conventional guy. He's obviously going somewhere. He's got a big rucksack. Yeah, he's wearing a helmet and he's got a road bike. He's got another bag as well. Yeah. And it is. You're absolutely right. I think it's more, you think about the kind of like the icons of riding in Copenhagen or in Amsterdam and what we aspire to. Those cycling cities are, I mean, immensely further down the road than we are, obviously, in terms of the numbers, but they're much more homogenous. Mm. It's like you can see a Dutch bike rider and they'll be riding a Dutch bike.
Yeah.
And they'll be identified to be Dutch and you'll know exactly where you are. In London, it's just absolute. All sorts of different folk now on all sorts of different. It's really quite a unique London story that I think. It's kind of scattered into a million constituent parts.
And isn't it just a really joyous thing to see as well? Like you're people spotting all different types of folks, different types of bikes, different types of scenes. And that's just it. It's like you don't have to belong to one particular cycling scene. That's what I've enjoyed in my time of being in cycling, that I've dabbled in road cycling. I've dabbled with going around like a velodrome track. I want to dabble in mountain biking. It's just all of these different things that are there. And it's just this wonderful mishmash of people on bikes is what I want to say. It's just people on bikes in this city. Seeing more of it would be amazing.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful, a wonderful way to end the podcast. But before we end the podcast, I wanted to do my bit of the deal and plug your podcast as well.
So, and your book. What's the title of your book?
Back in the Frame is the name of my book.
Back in the Frame.
Yes.
That reminds me, obviously, you wrote your book, but there's a certain sports person I ended up staying in a shared flat that he used, and he had a copy half-read of his own book on the bedside table.
Who was that?
Oh, Mark Cavendish.
Wow.
Mark, good book this.
Mark Cavendish once asked me who I'd got to ghostwrite my book. I wrote it myself.
It's a good book. Jules's book is really good. Your experience growing up. And
what is interesting and sort of suitable for where we are at the moment, when I had to do the paperback version of it, the new introduction chapter was all about why my life changed when I got my Brompton. So, yeah, that was a game changer of a bike for me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, George. The podcast is called Adventures in Coffee, and I will expect a plug for Streets Ahead on Adventures in Coffee next time.
Of course. I'm recording this afternoon, actually. So, yeah, we will make sure that gets in there.
Well, that's enough mutual back scratching. All the usual thing, please, what do we say here at this point, Adam?
Well, I would say subscribe to the podcast, share it, stuff. But please do leave a review and please do comment, because it genuinely makes an impact. People just listen over this bit and they go to the next one. But please stop now. Open up the podcast
review.
Post a review.
A good one. Don't write a bad one.
Well,
we're quite needy people, so emotionally fragile, and we need bolstering.
Yes.
I am, anyway.
Do that on a podcast app. 5 stars. Bang. And that will really help more people find out about urbanism and active travel and parklets and great things. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.